In the year of 1937, tensions between the Empire of Japan and the Republic of China reached their boiling point. Japan, of course, had initiated arguably an undeclared war against China back in 1931 when they invaded Manchuria and created the puppet state of Manchukuo. Ever since then, they had been working to encroach further into northern China to seize key industrial sectors, reaping raw materials for their military. As Dan Carlin once put it, Japan got a taste of Manchuria and it became a steroid. They began exploiting resources, and in turn, their entire industry became dependent on it. They needed more and more. Chiang Kai-shek was not in a position to face Japan back in 1931. He had just reunited China after his northern expedition. Various other incidents occurred after the Mukden incident. Yet Chiang Kai-shek did everything he could to limit the conflicts that emerged, never allowing anything to escalate into a full-scale battle. There was an extremely uneasy peace. Many within the Kwangtung army, especially those who had orchestrated the Mukden incident, were trying to do the very same thing to start a full-scale war with China. Hey everyone, I just wanted to let you know I now have a Patreon account found at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel. Over there you can find exclusive Patreon episodes and podcasts based on suggestions from patrons, and other benefits like early access to all of my content, live hangouts, your name in the end credits, and much, much more, so please go check it out. On the night of July the 7th, 1937, Kwangtung Army units stationed at Phong Thai crossed the border and conducted a military exercise. Allegedly, a Japanese soldier, Private Shimura Kikujiro, had disappeared from his post. The Chinese regimental commander, Ji Shi Wing, of the 219th Regiment, received a message from the Japanese demanding permission to enter the walled city of Wanping to search for their missing comrade. The Chinese refused. Despite the fact Private Shimura would reemerge, claiming he had just gone off due to a stomachache, heading into the woods to relieve himself, whereupon he had got lost, both the Chinese and Japanese began mobilizing around Wanping. That night, the Japanese attempted to breach Wanping, but they were repulsed. The Japanese followed this up with an ultimatum 2 hours later. At 2 a.m. on July the 8th, the executive officer, Jin Duquan, of the 29th Route Army, dispatched Wang Lengzhou, the mayor of Wanping, did go speak with the Japanese, but nothing came of this. The Japanese simply reinstated their demands to enter the city. At 4:45, the Japanese began firing, and this began the Battle of Beiping-Tianjin, the first battle of the Second Sino-Japanese War of 1937 to 1945. The Empire of Japan used what became known as the Marco Polo Bridge Incident, as during the battle, the Chinese defended said bridge, as a pretext to invade China. Beijing and the port city of Tianjin quickly fell to the IJA by August of 1937. Despite coming a very long way from 1931 in terms of military preparedness, Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek still knew they had no hope of facing the Japanese at this time. China had been receiving some military assistance from the West, notably from Germany and the USSR. Yet it was far from enough. Chiang Kai-shek envisioned numerous armies to face the Japanese, but said armies needed modern training, modern equipment, and above all, more time. Chiang Kai-shek struggled with what to do. Should he continue to appease the Japanese, hand even more territory and concessions to them, in the hopes that they would just stop their invasion at some point before toppling his government or forcing a protectorship over China? While from 1931 to 1936, this seemed to be working out, but the Japanese this time, they seemed to be going all in. But how could he make a stand? Alone, he would be crushed. He needed military intervention from the great powers, or at minimum, much more military material assistance from them. Thus, Chiang Kai-shek came up with an idea. He needed to show the great powers two things. The first, that the Japanese Empire was an aggressor set on conquering China. The second was that China would and could stand up to them. Now back over to the Japanese. The Imperial General Headquarters in Tokyo were honestly very content come August of 1937. The gains they made in northern China following the Marco Polo Bridge incident reaped very lucrative goodies for them. Many did not want to escalate what they still considered an incident into a real war. But this was going to be a hard one to bottle up. On August the 9th, Lieutenant Isawa Oyama of the Japanese Special Naval Landing Forces, the SNLF, was driving up to the gate of the Hongqiao Airport when a Chinese lieutenant guarding it stopped him. Oyama then shot and killed the guard, prompting other Chinese guards to fire upon him, and Oyama was killed in the shootout. Now, the Hongqiao Airport was barred from the Japanese under ceasefire terms signed back in 1932, during the Battle of Shanghai that very year. Oyama was in violation of those terms. Thus, the entire incident was Japan's fault. Regardless, the next day, the Japanese Consul General demanded the Chinese withdraw their Peace Preservation Corps and defensive works around the city of Shanghai. Meanwhile, the Japanese began reinforcing their military presence in Shanghai. With this situation fresh in hand, Chiang Kai-shek had found the location for his new plan. Meanwhile, starting on August the 12th, world powers like the United Kingdom, United States, France, and Italy began holding a joint conference to mediate the situation between China and Japan. The great powers did not want to see another battle over in Shanghai, like what had happened in 1932. This was because Shanghai was a truly international city. All of the great powers held concessions within Shanghai, such as the International Settlement. Thus, with all of these international peoples in Shanghai, it was the perfect stage for Chiang Kai-shek to show them all that China could and would stand up to Japan. Yet in order to do this, Chiang Kai-shek needed to take the very cream of his crop of forces to toss at the Japanese in Shanghai. The battle needed to fully showcase the capabilities of the Chinese forces, given the other world powers would be willing to train and arm them. Now, back in 1927, during the Northern Expedition, Chiang Kai-shek went to war with the CCP, breaking their first united front. Prior to this, the CCP had helped Chiang Kai-shek receive military assistance from the Soviet Union, but now that was cut off, so Chiang Kai-shek turned to Germany. The Weimar Republic began sending military advisors, but under strict regulation, because of the Treaty of Versailles. When Hitler came to power, he simply tossed the Treaty of Versailles in the garbage, and he began closely helping the Chinese, because they had a common enemy, communism. In 1934, General Hans von Seeckt, acting as the military advisor to Chiang Kai-shek, proposed a 60-divisional plan, reconstructing the NRA into 60 divisions of highly trained, well-equipped troops based on German doctrine. The 88th Division was the very first of these divisions to be created. Next came the 36th and then the 87th. Thus, these three divisions were the very cream of the crop of the NRA by 1937. Chiang Kai-shek tossed all three of these divisions into what became known as the Battle of Shanghai, 1937. Out of what would be 700,000 men, over 70 divisions, 80,000 of these men came from three German-trained divisions. Chiang Kai-shek also tossed 180 aircraft and 40 tanks. Quite literally, Chiang Kai-shek was tossing the kitchen sink at Shanghai. The German-trained divisions had Stahl helmets, German-styled weapons for their rifles and small arms, but their tanks and machine guns were all sorts of other European make. The defense of Shanghai consisted of three tank battalions. There were Polish FT-7s, French Renaults, Italian CV-33s, British model 1931 amphibious tanks, and some German Panzer Mark 1As. The frontline fighter aircraft for the Chinese Air Force at the very beginning of the full-scale hostilities consisted primarily of Curtiss Hawk 2s and 3s, with some Boeing P-26 model 281 P-shooters as well. Convinced that the Chinese training and equipment were inferior, the Japanese believed that the battle would have similar results to that of 1932, roughly with the same sort of casualties, but finishing off within a few days. Instead, it would take 3 months before the Chinese defenders finally submitted to the Japanese. Now, I can't stress this enough, as all historians who talk about this battle do. Chiang Kai-shek was taking an extreme risk by doing all of this. While yes, for his plan, it made sense to toss the kitchen sink, because it would ensure the battle would go for as long as possible and would showcase the extent of the Chinese military capabilities. But what if Chiang Kai-shek lost most of his German-trained divisions? The entire point of the German 60-division plan was for these German-trained guys to train the entire rest of the NRA. He could very well be sacrificing the very means of modernizing his military. Around 9 a.m. on August the 13th, the Chinese Peace Preservation Corps began skirmishing with Japanese troops in Jiabei, Wusong, and Jiangwan. These are districts in Shanghai. By 3 p.m., the Japanese forces crossed the Bazu Bridge in Jiabei, striking into the center of the city. Here, the 88th Division retaliated with mortar strikes. Street-to-street fighting raged. The Japanese were shocked. The Chinese they were facing were not pushovers at all. The Japanese HQ ordered ships of the 3rd Fleet,
at this time stationed along the Yangtze and Huangpu River, to navally bombard the Chinese positions in the Shanghai area. Late during the night, Chiang Kai-shek ordered a major offensive to begin the very next day. The morning of the 14th saw Chinese air forces bomb Japanese positions as the Chinese forces attacked. That same day, the Nanjing government proclaimed a self-defense and a war of resistance against the Japanese aggressors. But just to be clear, this was not an official call of war between nations. As American correspondent Edgar Snow described the scene from his observation point in the International Settlement,
"It was as though Verdun had happened on the Seine, in full view of the right bank of Paris, that was neutral, as though a Gettysburg were fought in Harlem, while the rest of Manhattan remained a non-belligerent observer." Thus began the Battle of Shanghai. The war aims of the battle was to hold out as long as possible, giving the Chinese government time to move vital industries into the interior, while showcasing their struggle front row and center to the international community. More specifically, Chiang Kai-shek told his generals to try and keep the intense battle in full view of the Shanghai International Settlement. The first phase of the battle raged from August the 13th to the 22nd, seeing the Chinese numerically superior to that of the Japanese. The Japanese forces were caught by surprise, and they were pushed towards the Huangpu River, where they were blockaded for quite some time. The 88th Division set up an HQ near Jaibei, while the 87th Division attacked the IGN forces near the Kongta Text Mill. Despite their efforts, the Japanese had heavily reinforced bunkers in their concession areas. The Chinese were simply unable to breach them. The Japanese then unleashed tanks into the streets, encircling and annihilating pockets of Chinese forces, gradually pushing them onto the defensive. The Chinese tried tossing their armor, but the Japanese anti-tank weapons tore them to pieces. Through sheer will of might, the Chinese nearly pushed the Japanese down to the Huangpu River, but casualties were immense. On the night of August the 22nd, the 36th Division lost 99 officers and about 1,000 troops alone. On that same day, the Japanese unleashed amphibious assaults with naval bombardments. The second phase was that of a stalemate, but the Chinese were losing massive amounts of troops as the Japanese just kept dispatching more and more forces to Shanghai via the IGN. The fighting soon spread across the Shanghai metropolis, particularly in the coastal areas where the IGN could land more and more under naval protection. Fierce battles were fought near Jiangyin, Liaodan, and Dacheng. Yet after losing key battles in said areas, Chiang Kai-shek knew it was all but over. They would have to finally withdraw from Shanghai. Thus, the third phase began on October the 26th, and it was here where our real story begins. The battle for Shanghai had raged for 3 months prior to this point. The district of Jaibei was crumbling. Thus, on October the 26th, Chiang Kai-shek gave the orders to withdraw Shanghai City to pull to the western rural region of Shanghai. Yet in order to safely do so, as in any military withdrawal, a rearguard was necessary. Chiang Kai-shek ordered General Gu Jutong, the acting commander of the 3rd Military Region, to leave the 88th Division behind, not only to buy time for the retreating forces, but to also put on a last grand show directly in front of the Shanghai International Settlement. It was a last-ditch effort to earn international support, as the 9 Great Powers were about to convene on November the 6th. However, General Gu Jutong was personally attached to the 88th Division and unwilling to leave it behind. And I might add, he was acting commander in his current post. His next post was to lead the 88th Division. Thus, he telegrammed the 88th Divisional commander at the time, General Sun Yuanliang, who also hated the plan to leave the 88th Division behind. Neither General Zhu Jugang nor Sun Yuanliang would disobey orders from the Generalissimo. However, Sun came up with an idea. They could leave a number of troops behind, just not the entire 88th Division. In his words,
"How many people we sacrifice would not make a difference. It would achieve the same purpose."
Sun proposed leaving behind a single regiment of the 88th Division to defend 1 to 2 heavily fortified positions. General Gu Jutong agreed to this plan. Now, at this time, the 88th Divisional HQ was at the Sihang Warehouse. The Sihang Warehouse is a 6-story concrete building situated in the Jaibei District, just north of the Suzhou Creek, at the northwestern edge of the new Lesse Bridge. The warehouse was built jointly by 4 banks, hence the name Sihang, which means 4 banks. On the other side of the Suzhou Creek lies the Shanghai International Settlement, a neutral territory where Western foreigners resided. The fighting would take place literally just across the creek, meaning the Western viewers were forced to watch up close the heroic last stand of China against the Japanese in Shanghai. Now, for those not aware, there is a fantastic film called The 800. Over at the Pacific War Channel on YouTube, I even did a film review of it. The movie does a great job of showcasing this incredible situation, where on one side of the river, there is an extravagant city of light, fun, entertainment, you know, casinos, bars, restaurants, and such. People really living it up. The international community are enjoying their lives. There's very vibrant colors. There's a lot of food and lights. On the other side of the creek, gray, crumbled buildings, a literal war zone. The Xiang warehouse sits there bullet-ridden as Japanese continuously try to storm it against Chinese defenders. It's a pretty cool movie. I do think you should check it out. And hell, please check out my review. Back to the story. Sun Yuanliang further thought an entire regiment was too much of a waste. Thus, he decided instead to leave an overstrength battalion. The 1st Battalion of the 524th Regiment was selected for the job. A young colonel, Xie Jinyuan, who was new to the 80th Division, volunteered to lead the battalion. Xie Jinyuan was not even familiar with the men of said battalion. He was tossed right into the water, as they say. The location for the battle, of course, was to be the Xihang warehouse. The 1st Battalion originally contained 800 men, but casualties suffered over the course of the Battle of Shanghai had reduced their strength prior to the defense of the Xihang warehouse to about 452 men. Each soldier was equipped with a Hanyang 88 or a Chiang Kai-shek rifle, an 8mm Mauser, grenades, a German M1935 Stahlhelm, gas masks, with some Czech ZB-26 light machine guns, and four Type 24 Maxim guns. They would be facing the forces of the 3rd IJ Division, commanded by General Iwane Matsue, and the 10th Battalion, 8th and 9th Companies of the Shanghai Special Naval Landing Forces, under the command of Captain Okuchi Denshinchi. He was further reinforced by roughly 260 sailors of the Yokosuka 2nd Independent SNLF Company, and about 200 sailors from the Kure 1st SNLF 2nd Company. The Shanghai SNLF's 8th and 9th Companies originally were attached to the 4th Artillery Battalion, who would also support with howitzers and mountain guns. Altogether, it was about 980 infantrymen from the Shanghai SNLF, reinforced with the 10th Battalion, and another 200 artillerymen from the 8th and 9th Companies, who would be involved in the actual assault against the Xihang warehouse. Xie Jinyuan consolidated his battalion's defenses inside the Xihang warehouse, believing it would give his men the very best chance of holding out for the maximum amount of time. He also correctly judged that the IGA would not be able to use their heaviest artillery pieces, aerial bombing, gas attacks, or naval guns, in fear of accidentally hitting the international settlement. Do remember, this is 1937. The Empire of Japan was not going to risk open war with any Western nations until 1941. What the Japanese would have access to is armored vehicles, such as Type 94 tankettes. The Japanese infantry were using the Arasaka Type 38 rifle, Type 11, and Type 96 light machine gun, the Nambu Type 14 pistol, the Type 92 heavy machine gun, Type 97 grenade, Type 89 grenade discharger, and the Type 93 flamethrower. On October the 27th, various companies of the battalion reached the Xihang warehouse after performing a fighting withdrawal. By this point, they were just 414 men, who essentially volunteered for a suicide mission and were later noted by Chiang Kai-shek to have, quote, exemplary soldierly conduct. The 1st Battalion commander was Army Major Yang Rui-fu, and their forces consisted of the 1st and 2nd and 3rd Companies and Machine Gun Company for a total of 452 men once the rest made it to the scene. Because of the 2 months of intense fighting in Shanghai, many of the German-trained elite troops were killed or wounded, leaving the majority of reinforcements that made up the 1st Battalion at the Xihang warehouse to be garrison troops from the surrounding provinces. Many of these men were from the 5th Regiment of the Hubei Province Garrison. Thus, quite a few of them were recent green recruits. On October the 27th, news began to circulate throughout Shanghai that there were still Chinese forces resisting the Japanese in the Jiabei district at the Xihang warehouse. At 4 a.m., a girl guide named Yang Huimin walked over to a British guard at a post at the Chinese end of the New Lesi Bridge, where she noticed a British soldier was tossing a pack of cigarettes into the warehouse. Yang Huimin asked the British soldier what he was doing, and he told her there was a full battalion of Chinese soldiers inside. She then wrote a message and asked the soldier to put it inside a cigarette box and toss it over. Soon thereafter, the Chinese tossed back the cigarette box with a message, indicating they wanted food, ammunition, and lubricant for their weapons. Thus, Yang Huimin left the bridge and began pleading at the Shanghai Chamber of Commerce for help, but no one believed her story. Xie Jianyuan deployed the first company, led by Captain Tao Xingchuan, on the right side of the warehouse along the Tibet Road. The third company, led by Xie Meihao, on the left across the bank of the communications building, and the second company, led by Deng Ying, on the other side. Two heavy type 24 Maxim machine guns were installed on the Xiang warehouse's rooftop, with other machine guns spread out for each company. A forward platoon from each company was set out to provide early warning of enemy attack. Xie Jianyuan ordered his combat engineers to place remote detonated charges in front of the warehouse. Xie Jianyuan's units were dispersed with rifles and machine guns throughout the warehouse and the rooftop. They reinforced the building with bags of sand, corn, and beans, and they raised surrounding buildings to clear a killing field. At 7 a.m., the IJ 3rd Division reached the Shanghai North Railway Station, and by 1 p.m., they were in the general vicinity of the warehouse. First bloodshed occurred when 10 IGA were killed trying to secure fortifications around the Xiang warehouse that were rigged with explosives. At 2 p.m., an NRA platoon led by Yin Chucheng exchanged fire with around 50 IGA. By 3 p.m., a IGA company of around 194 men launched an attack on the warehouse from the west. The third company commander, Xu Meiyao, was shot in the face, but he continued to command the defenses until he was shot again in the leg. Around 70 IGA took cover in a blind spot just southwest of the warehouse. The NRA, in response, climbed to the rooftop and began throwing grenades at the IGA, killing 7 and wounding another 20. The initial IGA assault was a complete failure, and in response, they began setting fire to the northwest section of the warehouse where fuel and lumber was stored. By 5 p.m., the fire was put out as the IGA were busy looting the Jaibei area. At 9 p.m., Battalion Commander Yang Raifu believed there was no more IGA attacks for the day, so he ordered the NRA to repair the fortifications and to eat their meals. No one slept that night. The NRA had suffered 2 deaths, 4 wounded, while the IGA had suffered 17 deaths and 20 wounded. The next morning, Xie Jianyuan called the Shanghai Chamber of Commerce asking for assistance, as Yang Huimin tossed their phone number over to him. At 7 a.m. on October the 28th, Japanese bombers began to circle the warehouse, but they did not drop any bombs for fear they might hit the international settlement. Then a sea of rising sun flags surrounded the rooftops of buildings around the Xiang warehouse. The Japanese were trying to intimidate the NRA, letting them know that they were surrounded. At around 8 a.m., Xie Jianyuan gave the defenders a pep talk atop the Xiang warehouse. Once upon, he noticed a IGA squad advancing along the Suzhou Creek. According to Yang Raifu's memoirs, Xie Jianyuan picked up a rifle and he killed one of the IGA soldiers from over a kilometer away, halting the entire squad's advance. At 3 p.m., it began to rain as the IGA launched a major attack against the western side of the warehouse, occupying the Bank of Communications building in the process. The Japanese occupying the communications building began to deploy machine guns and cannons to smash the northern face of the warehouse. The cannons were unable to heavily damage the 6-foot-thick walls of the warehouse, and the Japanese troops in the bank building were easily suppressed by defenders atop the roof of the warehouse, who held a higher vantage point. After 2 hours, the Japanese gave up on the attack. But in the meantime, they managed to cut the electricity and the water to the Xiang warehouse, forcing the defenders to institute rationing. Seeing the fierce Chinese resistance, the Shanghai Chamber of Commerce began to become exhilarated, and word quickly spread along the radio waves of their stand. Crowds of 30,000 people gathered around the southern bank of the Suzhou Creek, cheering on the defenders. Then 10 truckloads of aid were donated by Shanghai citizens, making transits over the bridge to the warehouse throughout the night. The defenders received food, fruits, clothing, utensils, and letters from citizens. A couple of journalists came over, but the commanding officer was too busy to talk, and the journalists ended up meeting with Lei Xiong, the machine gun company commander. Xie Jianyuan managed to use the same trucks that brought over the supplies to bring 10 of his wounded men back into the international settlement. While the trucks were moving back and forth over the bridge, 3 NRA were killed by Japanese sharpshooters. Yang Huimin courageously ran to the warehouse to personally deliver a Republic of China flag to Xie Jianyuan. He personally accepted the flag, and when asked by a reporter his plans, he simply stated, "Defend to the death." Yang Kuimin asked for a list of the soldiers' names to announce to the entire country. Shi Jianyuan did not want to give such information, however, as it would showcase his actual numbers to the Japanese, prompting them to just storm the warehouse. Thus, instead, he wrote down 800 names from the original 524th Regimental roster. And this is how the legend of the 800 heroes was born. The next morning, the Republic of China flag was hoisted on a 13-foot pole atop the Xiang warehouse. Yang Kuiman had only delivered a flag with no pole. Thus, they had to make a makeshift pole using two bamboo combs tied together to hold a flag-raising ceremony. A crowd of 30,000 in the international settlement watched on and shouted, "Zhonghua, Mingguo Wanzu." Long live the Republic of China. Then Japanese aircraft attempted to destroy the flag with strafing fire, but they failed to do so, and they were forced away by anti-aircraft fire. At noon that day, the IJA launched the largest offensive thus far, hitting the warehouse from all three directions, using Type 94 tankettes and cannons. The 3rd NRA Company was pushed out of the defensive lines to the base of the warehouse, then again into the warehouse itself. The IJA cannon fire had chipped away at the warehouse structure, creating new firing ports and a windowless west wall. The IJA attempted to scale the walls to the second floor using ladders. Xie Jianyuan was positioned near a window when two IJA soldiers managed to climb into the second floor beside him. He choked the first to death and shot the other while kicking over the ladder they had used. The situation was looking quite dire, as a platoon of IJA began placing explosives to breach the west wall. When the Chinese noticed what they were doing, the 21-year-old private Chen Xucheng, armed with a grenade vest, jumped from the second-story window onto the IJA platoon, planting the explosives. His suicidal attack killed himself and 20 Japanese below. The fighting lasted until it got dark, with waves of IJA storming the warehouse using armed vehicles. The IJA eventually had to give up the assault and instead began digging a tunnel using an excavator to the warehouse. In response, posters emerged in the international settlement showcasing the movement of the IJA to the NRA. At 7 a.m. on October the 30th, the IJA recommenced their attacks, this time with heavy artillery, approximately shooting one shell per second for the entire duration of the day. The NRA responded by refortifying the warehouse with more sandbags. When night approached, the IJA used floodlights to illuminate the warehouse for artillery fire to continue. Yet for all of their firepower, the defenders still managed to destroy some of the IJA armored vehicles. The international settlement then pressured the IJA to stop their artillery fire, as it was dangerously close to them. They then told the IJA they would try to convince the NRA to cease the defense. They sent Chiang Kai-shek a petition to stop fighting for humanitarian concerns. By this point, the defense of the Xiang warehouse had met all its objectives. The NRA forces in Shanghai had successfully redeployed in more favorable positions in the rural west. The defense of the warehouse had also gained the attention of the Western world. Thus, Chiang Kai-shek gave the green light to retreat. Chiang Kai-shek ordered the battalion to retreat into the foreign concession, then rejoin the 80th Division, who are now fighting in Western Shanghai. A meeting was made with the British general, Telfer Smollett, and Yang He of the Shanghai Auxiliary Police Force to facilitate the retreat. The 524th Regiment would retreat to the international settlement by crossing the New Lesse Bridge. The 3rd IJA Divisional Commander, Matsue Iwane, was notified of this, and he agreed, promising to allow the defenders to retreat unmolested. He would, of course, not make good on this promise. At midnight on November the 1st, Xie Jianyuan led the retreat of 376 men out of the warehouse and over the New Lesse Bridge into the international settlement. By this point, 10 NRA had been killed, with 77 too wounded to move. Thus, they volunteered to stay behind and man machine guns on the rooftop to cover the retreat. During the retreat, another 10 NRA were wounded by Japanese sharpshooters. At 2 a.m. on November the 1st, the retreat was complete, ending the defense of the Xiang warehouse. After the battle, Xie Jianyuan stated an excess of 100 Japanese troops had been killed by the defenders. General Sun Yuanliang stated, "Enemy corpses in the vicinity of the Xiang warehouse totaled over 200 approximately." Xie Jianmin alleged, "More than 200 enemy troops were killed, and countless ones were wounded. Two enemy tanks were destroyed, and two more were damaged. The number of the enemies was the sum of the daily counts obtained by observational posts." The NRA had 10 deaths and 37 wounded, and the IJA had an estimated 200 killed with several wounded. I must add, however, the Japanese report indicated after the SNLF 10th Battalion stormed the Siang warehouse, they had found roughly 80 Chinese corpses. As of 2022, historians estimate 377 Chinese had managed to retreat. Thus, the death toll should have been something around 33. After the retreat, the British troops seized their weapons and placed the NRA under arrest. This was because the IGA threatened to invade the international settlement if they were allowed to leave the area. Chiang Kai-shek promoted every defender by a rank and awarded Shi Jianyuan and Yang Weifu the Order of the Blue Sky and White Sun. The media capitalized on the defense of the Siang warehouse and lauded the 800 heroes as national heroes, even creating a patriotic song, China Will Not Perish, about them. Despite the heroic efforts during the Battle of Shanghai, until Japan unleashed its war on the West, only Germany and the USSR would significantly provide assistance to China. The fate of the 800 heroes is quite tragic. They became known as the Lost Battalion Barracks, trapped for 3 years within the international settlement. Later on, Wang Jingwei's collaborationist government made numerous offers to Shi Jianyuan to release his men, but he refused them. On April the 24th of 1941, Shi Jianyuan was assassinated at 5 a.m. by Sergeant Hu Dingcheng, who was working for Wang Jingwei. Shi Jianyuan's funeral was attended by over 100,000 people, and he was posthumously made a brigadier general of the NRA. Shi Jianyuan's body was placed in a small garden along the Yao Road, where his bunk used to be. In 1947, the Shanghai city government renamed Jiaoyuan Park, where the soldiers had lived, as Jinyuan Park. They also renamed an elementary school in the vicinity, the 12th District Jinyuan National Elementary School. The road to the west of the warehouse was also renamed Jinyuan Road. Then on April the 16th of 1983, Shi Jinyuan's grave was moved over to the Wanguo Public Mausoleum, where other Chinese patriots are buried. That same year, the barracks area was rebuilt and named Jinyuan Alley. In March of 1986, the city council of Zhi's hometown, Jiaoling, of Guangdong province, set up a monument in his honor. As for the others in the Lost Battalion, after the Pearl Harbor attack and the declaration of war against the Western Allies, the Japanese forces occupied the international settlement and captured the soldiers still stuck there. Many were shipped to Hangzhou and Shangling-wei to do hard labor. Some were sent to Papua New Guinea to do hard labor. And by the end of the war, they overpowered their Japanese captors and imprisoned them. To this day in Shanghai, the warehouse still stands at the Sihang Warehouse Memorial Museum, which opened up in 2015. If you go there, you can see remains of the building accompanied with details of the battle, photographs, maps, recollections, and wax models of the defenders. And as I've already mentioned, the battle was made into the 2020 film titled The 800, which became the second highest grossing film of 2020. Really hope you like this episode, and please, if you've not already done so, please go check out the Pacific War channel over on YouTube, where I cover the history of the Second Sino-Japanese War of 1937 to 1945 and all the major events before it. Also, please check out my Patreon account over at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel, where for as low as $2 a month, you get access to my Patreon-exclusive podcast. But stating all of that, this has been the Pacific War Channel, over and out.